All right. There's this theory about discipleship. There's a number of books written about how do we do effective discipleship. And this theory says that you actually need two variables for effective discipleship. The first variable is a place of safety, a place of comfort, where you feel affirmed in who you are, and you are feeling like, yes, I can be who I am, and I can feel safe to share that. So that's one aspect of effective discipleship and spiritual maturity and growth. The second aspect is you actually need discomfort. It sounds contradictory, doesn't it? You need a place of safety and you need a place of discomfort. But it actually makes a lot of sense. Because if you just feel safe, you have no motivation or reason to grow. Why would you? You feel safe and comfortable where you are. But then again, if you just had discomfort, where things are constantly being challenged all the time, then why would you grow? Because you just are kind of anxious all the time, and a constant state of anxiety is not conducive to growth. So the best place of growth, spiritual maturity and discipleship, is where you have both and, where you trust the other person because you're in a place of safety, but also there is the introduction of certain places of discomfort, and that spurs on change and the room and the capacity to grow. So I hope last night, I hope we're at a place now where there's a certain degree that this is a safe place, where we are at least beginning to get to know one another, and I'm thankful for 44, was it? Wow, that's fantastic. That's so great. And then those who are here for the first time, to feel that this is a safe community. And one of the things that, I'm a pretty intuitive person, and to sense that this church is one of those places where you can feel safe. So I want to honor that, just kind of from the short time that I've been here to be able to sense that. But also that not just a place of safety and comfort, but also a place where we are stretched in our thinking. So this morning, I want to try to stretch us in our thinking a little bit. And the best way to facilitate that is to go through the book of Acts and to talk about a time in the early church where there were significant changes going on, and to see how 2,000 years later, we might be experiencing those same changes, and how the Bible tells us the early church responded, and how that might instruct us in our time as well. So I'm going to go for about 40 minutes, and we're going to have about 10, 15 minutes of question and answer. So if there are certain things that are stirring, just jot them down, and we want to make sure we have a little bit of a dialogue about some of the information that I'm presenting to you this morning. Let me say a quick word of prayer this morning. God, I'm thankful for our time together, thankful for this place where we can engage in your truths that come out of Scripture, but also know that you are here present for us and showing your amazing grace and mercy, not only in your presence here, but also your presence in each other's lives as well. So we thank you for this moment where we can approach the throne of God and to learn from what you have in your Scripture. We pray this in your name. Amen. By the way, my email is right there. If you have any questions that don't get answered during our time here, please feel free to email me. It might take me a little while to get back to you, but I try to answer as many of my emails as I can. So if you want to further probe some of the questions that I'm raising, obviously my first book is on this topic, and there are a couple of other works that I think I'll reference that might be helpful as well. I want to talk about Acts chapter 15 and the changing world that we encounter in Acts chapter 15 and the changing world we encounter now in the 21st century and the parallels and the similarities that we see and how the church responded then and how the church can respond now. Let me begin with telling you about what happens in Acts chapter 15. Acts 15 is the account of the Jerusalem Council. And that's the story of a group of elders in the early church that get together to talk about some things that are going on in the church at that time. One of the most pivotal events in the early church. And there are a couple of things that are happening. The first thing that was happening is that there was a pre-existing animosity, a pre-existing hatred even, almost a very deep-seated hatred, animosity, towards Gentiles. Now, you got to remember that Christianity started in the Judeo context. So these were Jewish believers who believed that they had found the Jewish Messiah in the person of Jesus. So they were still steeped in a Jewish frame of reference, both theologically and culturally as well. And so there was a real sense of maybe superiority of Judaism over against the Gentile believers. In fact, the pious Jewish male would pray the following prayer. He would pray, first of all, I thank you that I'm not a female. Second of all, I pray that I'm thankful that I'm not a dog. And best of all, I thank you that I'm not a Gentile. So you can get the sense of this animosity towards the Gentile community. But something was changing in the church in the book of Acts. And that was that there was a successful mission to the Gentile community. most of the story that we know of through the Apostle Paul, but also with Barnabas. We see these Christians, new Christians, going into Gentile communities, non-Jewish communities, and they're now becoming Christians. And it is at this moment in church history, in Acts chapter 15, that the numerical shift is about to occur. So prior to this moment, the majority of Christians are of Jewish origin who convert or who actually see Christianity as a fulfillment of Judaism. But it is at this moment in Acts chapter 15 that the number of Gentile believers is about to exceed the number of Jewish believers. So there's going to be a power shift, a change in the demographics of Christianity in the world. Now, what I want to point out is that what happened 2,000 years ago in Acts chapter 15 and the need to deal with this demographic change is the same scenario that we're seeing in the 20th and 21st century, that there is a change in the demographics of Christianity. In the same way, Christianity shifted from being dominated by Jewish Christianity to a shift towards Gentile Christianity, and the concern about what does that mean for the church in the first century, we are seeing the demographic shift of Christianity in the 20th and 21st century. Historian, missiologist Dana Robert, who teaches at Boston University, puts it in this way. If you were to gather all the Christians together and ask and pick out a person that represents the face of Christianity in the year 1950, what would that person look like? What would the typical Christian from the year 1950 look like? And if your answer was white male, approximately 50 years old, living in an American Midwestern suburb, you would be correct. That would be, except maybe that last guy, that would be the typical face of Christianity globally. All throughout the world, you say, this is what a Christian looks like, or the majority of Christians fall into this category, upper middle class, white, suburban, male. That's probably the standard face of Christianity in the year 1950. Now, Dana Robert asked that question 50 years later, and so let's ask the question as well. What does a typical Christian look like in the year 2013? Right now, if we were to get all the Christians together in one room and say, who represents the face of Christianity? Well, the answer is it's no longer the white male who lives in an American suburb who is upper middle class, but it's actually more likely to be a Nigerian peasant woman outside of Lagos, Nigeria, a teenager in Mexico City, Mexico, or a university student in Seoul, South Korea. So in about 50 plus years, we went from a Christianity where the typical face was represented by a white male in an American suburb to much more urban, but also international. Africa, Asia, and Latin America are now the centers of Christianity. We can look at it in these terms as Philip Jenkins, the author of the book, The Next Christendom, puts it. For 500 years, for about five centuries, the story of Christianity was bound up with European and European-American Christianity, so that the overwhelming majority lived in the white nations of Europe and North America. And so you can speak of Christianity as Europeanized and Europe as Christianized and North America as Christianized. So you can speak of a European Christianity or a Euro-American Christianity. However, if you look at the history of the last 100 years or so, starting in the 20th century and now into the 21st century, the center of Christianity has shifted from North America and Europe to Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Let's put it in kind of graphic visual terms here. If you were to, in the year 1900, take a thumbtack and put it on the map of the world of the demographic center of Christianity, you would put it right in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean. Because in the middle of the North Atlantic shows that so much of the world Christian population is found in Europe and North America. And that's where you would put the pin in the year 1900. If you took that same pin and moved it in the year 2000 to the geographic center of Christianity in the world, it would be right outside of Timbuktu, Africa. And the authors of this book argue that every day or so, you would have to take one step southward and one step eastward, because that's how fast the center of gravity of Christianity is moving from North Atlantic, Europe and North America, to Africa, Asia, and Latin America. We can look at it through these numbers. In the year 1900, you get all the Christians together, you find out that 68% of the Christians in the world are on the continent of Europe, 14% are in North America. You see a very small percentage, only 2% of Christians in the world in Africa, 4% in Asia, 11% in Latin America. So that the majority of Christians in the world are considered of European descent. About 83% of the Christians in the world would be considered of European descent. By the year 2005, the numbers, as you can see, have changed dramatically. You go from 2% of the world's Christian population in Africa all the way up to 19%. You see the increase in Asia from 4% of the world Christian population to 17%. And where do you see the biggest drop? And you see an increase in Latin America as well from 11 to 24%. But the biggest drop is clearly in Europe, where 68% of the world Christian population was in the year 1900. And within 100 years or so, it dropped all the way down to 26%. So that right now, in the world, the majority of all Christians in the world are comprised not of European or those of European descent. The majority of Christians are actually of African, Asian, and Latin American descent. So right now, if you add up the continent of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and take all the Christian in those three continents, you have a clear majority, 60% of the Christians in the world of non-European origin. The projection is that by the year 2050, the numbers are going to change even more. Africa, again, continues to increase so that by the year 2050, almost a third or 29% of the world Christian population will be found in Africa, 20% will be in Asia, 22% will be in Latin America, and only 16% in Europe, and only 12%, you see a small but steady decline in North America, a sharp precipitous decline in Europe going from 68% down to 16%. So what we're talking about is within the next generation, within the next 30, 40 years, more than 71% of Christians in the world are going to be in the continents of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And I have put in quotation marks the word white and non-white, because even these figures are actually not accurate, because you have to take into account the percentage of Christians in Europe that are now of non-European descent. Philip Jenkins, in his books, God's Continent, talks quite a bit about the growth of non-white churches in Europe. The fastest growing church in London is a Nigerian church. The fastest growing church in Sweden, Stockholm, Sweden, is an African church. The fastest growing church in Kiev, Russia, is pastored by a Nigerian. The fastest growing church in Paris is pastored by an Algerian. So we're talking about these communities where you're seeing this spectacular growth of the church, and it's usually in the African, Asian, Latin American communities, even on the continent of Europe. Now, my research has been in the area of North American Christianity. What's happening in American Christianity? And so this number that I have put in for kind of simplicity purposes, and we add up the white continents of Europe and North America, and that and Oceania, which is Australia, and that adds up to 29%. This number is actually lower, first of all, because European Christianity is diverse, but also because North American Christianity is now extraordinarily diverse. And this is what I want to focus on. Philip Jenkins notes that this really dramatic change in global Christianity is actually not known by most of us here in the West. We still kind of assume Christianity is centered in Europe, but certainly in North America, especially in the United States, without recognizing that there are these dramatic changes that are occurring and that Christianity is no longer predominantly European or North American faith. Now, what I want to talk about then is what's happening in American Christianity that reflects these international and global trends. Jenkins writes that the passage of the Immigration Reform Act in 1965 may be the most significant event of that particular decade, so that the U.S.'s ethnic character is becoming less European and Euro-American and much more diverse and ethnically, culturally diverse. And most of you are very much aware of this now, especially if you're living in California, especially if you're living in Northern California, that the demographics of our nation are changing very dramatically. Just some quick statistics here. In 1965, the immigration laws were changed. So the last time we had any kind of immigration laws was almost 50 years ago, which is a very long time because so many things have happened in those last 50 years. So for us to be operating under a law that made sense in 1965, it doesn't make sense 45, 50 years later to try to operate under those same laws. But the law changed in 1965. So prior to 1965, there were very strict limitations on who could immigrate to the United States. And they were very racially based. So the very first law that prohibited certain groups from coming into the United States was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. Can anybody guess what that did? It excluded Chinese. So, well, it was a very clear, explicit law that said, we do not want Chinese immigrants in the United States. Now, there were more kind of different laws as well that did essentially the same thing. There was something called the Gentleman's Agreement between the U.S. and Japan, and it was said that we'll take a very small number of immigrants from Japan, but they have to be professionals. They have to be academics, doctors, or those who have higher levels of education, so that the immigration from Japan was limited to a certain number. The Chinese Exclusion Act was after there was an influx of Chinese who came in to help build the railroads on the West Coast, here on the West Coast. So you had immigration that was oftentimes used for labor and also very specific about who they wanted in the country and not in the country. So prior to 1965, there was a very strict quota system that said almost all of our immigration is really going to come from Europe. Now, just to clarify, even after the change in laws in 1965, we still have a quota system. This is what most people do not understand. We do not have unlimited immigration right now. We have very strict guidelines on how many people can come into the United States from certain countries. So if you're a Filipino wanting to come into the United States, there's a 35-year waiting list in order to make become an immigrant to the United States. So we're talking about existing laws that just change the pie. So prior to 1965, you had a limited number of immigrants, and then post-1965, you changed the pie to mostly European to now more African, especially Asian and Latin American immigration. And the pie gets a little bit larger every year, but you still have very strict limitations on how many immigrants come into the United States. But it is still very important to note that in 1965, the laws change, and now for one of the first times you have a larger number of immigrants coming from outside of Europe and now coming from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So that from 1965 to the present, the majority of immigrants now coming into the United States are coming from Latin America, Africa, and Asia, but particularly Latin America and Asia. The year 2008 was a landmark moment, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, that was the date that it was projected that we crossed the threshold where a third of our nation is now considered immigrant. Ethnic minorities, non-white. Now, I believe California crossed that threshold of 50% of non-white like 10, 15 years ago. It was quite a while ago. I remember, actually, I was flying into California, actually into San Francisco for a conference, and this was spent about 15 years ago, and the headline was, California now officially a state where the majority is the minority. And so we're seeing this projection happening very quickly, so that a few years back, we now have a third of all of the U.S. population now of non-European descent. This is an interesting one. By the year 2023, half of the children in the United States are going to be of non-European descent. And by the year 2042, the U.S. population will officially cross over so that there is no clear ethnic majority in the United States. Now, that number varies. Sociologists are playing around with that number. Anywhere from 2040 to 2050, that's going to happen. But I want us to pay attention to this particular number here. That by the year 2023, half of the children are going to be minorities. So what this tells us, now, that's 10 years away. That's not, 20 years from now or 30 years from now. That's 10 years away. What this number tells us is that the growth of the minority population and this number is not pegged to immigration, it's pegged to birth patterns. So birth patterns are going to determine what's going to happen with this number. So no matter what you do with the immigration laws, and I personally believe we need to reform them because we're operating under antiquated rules, well, no matter what we do with immigration laws, we're going to end up with this happening because this is not pegged to immigration, it is pegged to birth rates. So by the year, I kind of notice this here, right? You notice that the younger the group gets, the more diverse your church is, right? Have you kind of noticed that? I noticed it right away, that your children's ministry is probably the most diverse group in your church right now. And that's only going to keep increasing, because we're seeing that by the year 2023, half of the children in the United States, again, in California, you've already probably passed this threshold where the birth rates are already at a place where the majority are the ethnic minorities. What this means is that no matter what you do with immigration laws, you're going to get an ethnic minority majority in the United States. So these are just kind of demographic realities. It's demographic realities that politicians are now beginning to deal with. One of the great interesting analyses that occurred after the 2012 election, it's not a political statement at all. It was just interesting how many people were talking about the Latino and Asian vote and the percentage of the Latino and Asian vote that went for Barack Obama in contrast to the other ethnic communities and the vote that occurred there. So that's just a demographic sociological statement that we are living in a nation that is rapidly becoming officially, fully ethnically diverse, and we're living in a nation where dealing with that diversity is just more and more of a reality. It happens in our school system. It happens in our churches now. It happens in our political system. It happens everywhere you turn. And again, being in California, you've seen this happening already. California population demographics is kind of at the cutting edge of this, and that California is one of the earlier states where you've seen this incredible diversity going on. So this is not a possibility. This is a reality. This is the way the world is. We are living in a nation that is extraordinarily ethnically diverse. Now, there was a theory about this diversity. And that theory is that the more diverse you are, the less Christian America is going to be. And this theory was first put out by a Harvard religion professor by the name of Diana Eck. Diana Eck is a Hindu scholar who was given $1 million. How do you get $1 million like that to do some research? And here's the sad part of it. The $1 million was kind of wasted because her research has actually been largely debunked. But Diana Eck's $1 million research was this, that the more diverse America becomes because of immigration, the less Christian this nation will be. And to some extent, that's true. Because 10 years ago, if you walked by a certain neighborhood, you didn't have a Buddhist temple. And now there's a Buddhist temple there because of the growth of the Southeast Asian community. 10 years ago, if you walked through a certain neighborhood, you didn't have a Hindu temple. And now, because of the growth of the South Asian community, you now have Hindu temples. So Eck's hypothesis was the more you become diverse and bring immigrants from other parts of the world, they're coming with their Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim faith, and therefore, at the end of this process, America's going to get more, as it becomes increasingly more diverse, it's going to get less and less Christian. Now, X hypothesis has proven to be actually completely off. And part of it is that what Eck didn't realize is that many of the immigrants are actually coming with Christian faith. There is a higher percentage, and this is pretty well documented, the proportion of American immigrants who come from their country of origin, the percentage of Christians is always higher than their country of origin. So simply put, if Korea is 40% Christian, 75% of first-generation Korean immigrants are Christian. So it is consistently true that no matter what your population religious orientation is in your home country, it is more likely that when you come to the United States that Christians are more likely to immigrate, and actually folks are more likely to become Christians once they come to the United States. So the key statistic is if Korea is 40% Christian, 75% of Koreans in the United States, especially in the first generation, are Christian. So it's always a higher number than your country of origin. This is actually true in the Arabic community. We tend to think all Arabs or those from the Middle East are Muslim. Turns out that Christians actually comprise a pretty significant percentage of the Arabic community. It's a self-reported number, so it's hard to tell, but they self-report that anywhere from 15 to 20% of Arabic Americans are actually Christian, and the Muslims are the largest majority, but there's a very significant number of Arabic Christians in the United States. In fact, a few years ago back in Boston, I was asked to speak at a church retreat, an Arabic evangelical church retreat. It was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. There were about 300 in the first generation congregation. They were from all over the Middle East, Syrian, Palestinian, Egyptian, kind of the whole range. They had services in Arabic, and they asked me to come to their youth and college students, their English-speaking young adults. And there were about 50 to 70 English-speaking young adults, all of Arabic origin of some sort or another. It was an amazing, amazing retreat. I did find out, however, that there's one thing. When you speak at an Arabic church during the World Cup, do not expect a whole lot of attendance when you speak during one of the soccer games. And also expect that you're going to start about 3 hours later than expected, because, you know, here everything is kind of down to the minute. But at the Arabic church, they said, oh, you know, we're going to start at about 7, so I show up at 6:30. 3 hours later, I'm still there by myself. Finally, at about 9:30 after the soccer games are over, people start kind of strolling in. So there's kind of a different cultural element there. But here is this very dynamic church, an Arabic community, a very large, substantial-sized Arabic community in Boston, a Christian community that very few people know about. And that's because we oftentimes think that immigrants come with their home culture faith, but without realizing that's oftentimes Christianity. And so what we have seen then is that the immigrant community is actually not contributing to the decline of Christianity in America. It's actually helping the growth of Christianity in America. And this is kind of counterintuitive because it seems to indicate that we are seeing the growth of the church rather than the decline of the church. Let me kind of skip ahead here. Oops, I'm sorry, I missed the slide here. But the quote I wanted to say to you was by Stephen Warner. And Stephen Warner has a hypothesis that contradicts Diana Eck's hypothesis. And Warner's hypothesis is this, that the more immigrants come to the United States, we are not seeing the de-Christianization of America, which was Eck's hypothesis, the de-Christianization of America. Warner says we're not seeing the de-Christianization of America, we are seeing the de-Europeanization of American Christianity. Do you see the difference? It's not that we're becoming less Christian because of immigrants. We're becoming less European Christian because of immigrants, because the immigrants are bringing Korean Presbyterian Christianity. They're bringing Arabic evangelical Christianity. They're bringing Southeast Asian Catholic Christianity. They're bringing Filipino Catholic and Pentecostal Christianity. So these are those who are coming from immigrant nations as immigrants, but they're bringing their Christian faith with them. And that's actually helping to sustain American Christianity. In contrast, there were two articles written in 2008 when my first book came out that said that there seems to be a decline in Christianity. In fact, the first was called The Collapse of Evangelicalism, written by Michael Spencer. Some of you might know his name. Michael Spencer wrote a blog called The Internet Monk. Michael actually passed away not that long ago at a relatively young age, but I met him at a conference, and we were talking about he had read my book and did a very nice review of my book, and so I asked him about his website, The Internet Monk, and he told me that it was one of the top 100 websites in the world. The blog that he wrote was one of the top 100 read in the entire world. And I said, how do you build a blog audience like that? And he said, I started writing this blog for disaffected Southern Baptists. And there's enough of us that it made our blog the number top 100 blogs in the world. Well, he wrote a series of articles, blog articles, that became one large article called The Collapse of Evangelicalism. And he was saying there seems to be a sharp decline of those who now begin to identify themselves as evangelicals. Around that same time, Jonathan Meacham of Newsweek did an article on Newsweek. Newsweek, by the way, along with Time, when they had their print editions, they always do the Christian issue right around Easter time. They think we Christians are so gullible, we buy extra copies when Jesus is on the cover. And sadly, it's true, because that's when their sales spike. So every year around Easter time, Time and Newsweek do their Christian issue. They put Jesus on the cover. They talk about Christianity. Well, this particular year, they actually had a pretty ominous cover. It was a black cover with red lettering in the shape of a cross that said, "The End of Christian America." So it sounds kind of ominous. And what Meacham was saying is that there is a sharp decline of those who are identifying themselves as Christians in America, and that Christianity is no longer shaping America. And they were drawing from the Pew and ARIS reports done by two different agencies. The Pew report does a lot of surveys on Christianity. ARIS is a report done by Trinity College called the American Religious Identification Survey. And both surveys were finding out that there was an increasing number of individuals who are identifying themselves as spiritual but not religious. How many of you have heard of this category? It's a pretty common language now that many people in America are now identifying themselves as spiritual and not religious. And that means that, you know, I might have grown up in the church, but I'm kind of sick of organized religion. So the way I get my spirituality is I hang out at a bar with some friends and we talk about Jesus sometimes. That's my spirituality. Or I grew up in the church and I got baptized in the church, but I don't really go in for that anymore. So what I do is I go to a New Age class, or I go to a Buddhist meditation temple. And so you have a number of individuals who grew up in the church who see themselves as spiritual beings because of their Christian formation and their upbringing, but now are dissatisfied or disconnected from organized religion. And that's a growing number. In fact, this is the fastest growing category of religious identification. Now, this seems to be in contrast to what George Barna says, that half of the Christians in America still attend church. So Barna and Gallup are two, they're both actually Christian pollsters who were trying to figure out what's the church participation in America. And they were saying that Barna says 45, 50%. Gallup goes as high as 60%. That right now, anywhere from 45 to 60% of Americans go to church on a Sunday. Now, if you've ever been driving out on a Sunday morning on your way to church, do you really think half of the Americans are on their way to church? In fact, those that are on the streets with you are probably headed to the mall or to a football game, more likely than they're actually going to church. So the question is, what's going on here? Is it really half of Americans are still going to church when these phone surveys are indicating that? So we probe a little bit deeper, and what we find out is that people lie about going to church. Sociologists have a name for it. They call it the halo effect. And that means you won't lie about who you voted for, you won't lie about your political opinions, but you will lie about going to church. So they'll call you up and say, hey, did you go to church on Sunday? Yeah, sure, why not? And then they'll mark you off as present. It turns out that half the people say they go to church. But what one of my friends and colleagues at the Covenant Church, my denomination, said, okay, they're lying about going to church, so let's actually figure out how many people are actually going to church. And it turns out that he did the survey not on phone surveys, a sample survey, but he actually took actual numbers of church attendance that denominations and churches report. Now, even there, those numbers feel a little bit inflated, right? Because I was a pastor, and when my denomination asked for my numbers of how many people were in church, and if I had 297 people at church that Sunday, what did I say? 300. Yeah, because Father, Son, Holy Spirit were also present, so clearly I had 300 people at church on Sunday. So even those numbers are probably slightly inflated, but what it showed is that only about 20% of American Christians actually attend church on Sunday. So if you go by actual numbers, in the year 1995, only 20% of Christians went to church, or Americans went to church, and by 2005, that number had actually gone down to 17.5%. So right now, only about 17, 18% of Americans regularly or actually attend church on Sunday. That's a little better than asking someone whether they went to church or not. So we're seeing this kind of discontinuity here, this disconnect, that we are saying that American church attendance is in decline, but what I would argue is that what is sustaining American church attendance is actually the immigrant churches. The immigrant churches are the one major growth areas in American society right now. So even though the white American evangelical churches in particular are in decline, the immigrant churches are actually increasing in number. So the contrast on this is we can talk about mainline churches. Mainline churches in about a 15-year time span lost 25% of their membership. These would be kind of the Protestant liberal mainline churches. They went from 1990 to 2005 from 4% of the population down to 3% of the population, meaning a quarter of their membership left their church. Now, Mark Shevs at Duke University says, many of those mainlines, some left the church altogether, and others went to evangelical churches. They got tired of maybe some of the theology of the mainline churches, so a percentage went to the evangelical churches, so that during that same time period, evangelical churches were relatively flatlined. But what was happening with the evangelical numbers is, one, you were getting a little bit of the boost from mainliners leaving mainline churches and joining evangelical churches, but you were also getting a boost from African-American, Latino, Asian, Native American, who were identifying themselves as evangelical and were increasing the number of evangelicals. So I'll give you an example of this. A few years ago, I was down in Washington, D.C. They had convened about 30 leaders together to talk about the issue of immigration reform. So this was actually way before, this was in 2007, before John McCain ran for president. He and Ted Kennedy put forth a bill to do immigration reform, and then when he ran for president, he backed away from that bill. But we were there to talk about that bill and the possibility of it helping Christians, and it was specifically a faith-based gathering. So a third of the group were actually congressional aides, and we had the chief aide who wrote the bill for McCain and the chief aide who wrote the bill for Kennedy. Both of them were there, and then other congressional aides were there to talk about the bill. A third of us were from the civic organizations that work with immigration, faith-based otherwise, and then a third were from churches and denominational leaders, etc. So the 30 of us are gathering, talking, and there was one denominational leader who talked about his denomination. And I'm not going to mention the denomination because it was supposed to be in confidence there, but if I said the name, you would recognize it. It is a pretty well-known, prominent, mid-sized American evangelical denomination. And he said, if you look at our church growth numbers, you will see that it's relatively flat. And we're pretty happy with that. because it means that we're keeping up with population. Our attendance and our church numbers are relatively flat. And if you look at the mainline church's numbers, they're in sharp decline. They're losing 25% a year. So we pat ourselves in the back as evangelicals. We're doing a great job. Now, we're not like those loser mainliners. They're losing church members all the time. Loser as in losing church members, not loser with a capital L. These losers, they're losing church members all the time. But we good old evangelicals, we're doing great. We're sustaining our population. But he said, but if you take out the immigrant churches from our numbers are just as bad as the mainline churches. So what it goes to show is that the immigrant churches and the immigrant communities are actually supporting and sustaining the evangelical congregations, because many of the immigrants identify more with evangelical denominations than they identify with the mainline denominations. So these are some of the major trends that we're seeing in American Christianity, where there seems to be a decline in white evangelicals, many of whom are now beginning to identify themselves as spiritual but not religious, but a growth and a sustaining of the church by the influx of immigrant evangelicals. So, what does this mean? I have a few other statistics up here that talk about the growth of the immigrant church in the city of Boston, where I pastored for many years. In 1970, about 300 churches were in the city of Boston. That's a small number, but Boston itself, the city of Boston, is only about 500,000 people. So that's about right. But the current estimate by the year 2006, these are number from 2006, is that there were about 600 churches. Now, I don't know about you, but when you think of a place like Berkeley or a place like Cambridge in Boston, you're kind of told, oh, those are spiritually dead places. Have you heard that about Berkeley? You know, you say, well, you're from Berkeley, and you go to another part of the country, and it's, oh, we're sorry for you. You know, Berkeley must be spiritually dead. I got that a lot when I was a pastor in Cambridge. I would go somewhere, and I would say, oh, I pastor in Cambridge. Oh, we're so sorry for you. We'll pray for you, because we know how terrible it is in Boston and Cambridge. So now, when I was moving from the D.C. area after I finished my undergrad, I was moving to Boston to go to seminary, I was told by my church, be careful, you're going to lose your faith in Boston. It's secular humanism at its worst. You know, like what they said about Berkeley. You know, you have to pray more, and you have to, and they actually laid hands and prayed for me. Please don't let him lose his faith in Boston. So I drive up I-95. I'm praying, Lord, don't let me lose my faith in Boston. And I get to Boston, and what do I find? I find one of the most vibrant Christian communities I've ever encountered. I find churches that are being planted all over the place. I find churches that are growing by leaps and bounds. But what kind of churches are they? They're actually not white evangelical churches. Many of those have closed down. In fact, there's a beautiful church building at the corner of one of the Back Bay neighborhoods in downtown Boston. And you walk up to it, and it's this historic building. It had been there from like the 19th century. And you say, what an awe-inspiring building. But then when you go around the corner, you realize that they left the wall up, but they gutted out everything behind it. So the facade of the church is there, but then behind it, they actually built a high-rise condo in its place. So when you walk up to it, what a beautiful church. When you walk around, oh, this is an apartment complex. So what you see is the decline of the church in such a way that churches, beautiful buildings that have been around for hundreds of years, are now condos, shelters, museums, anything but churches. These things are happening throughout the city of Boston. But then that seems to go counterintuitive to the fact that right now there are over 600 churches in the city of Boston. Well, what's happening? It turns out that most of these churches are ethnic immigrant churches, and over half of these churches hold a service in a language other than English. And on top of that, this doesn't account for example, African-American churches that have services in English. A church like mine, which was majority Asian-American, but it had services in English. Spanish-speaking churches that had services in English. Caribbean churches that had services in English. This doesn't even account for that. When you look at a time period in the 1980s, a 10-year time period, half of the churches planted during that time period were Spanish-speaking, and 25% were African-American, 15% were Asian-American, and less than 10% of the new church plants in a 10-year time period in the 90s were actually considered predominantly Anglo churches. You can see the dominance of immigrant and ethnic churches in that time period. So what we're seeing is the growth of the church in Boston, but it's actually happening among the immigrant communities. Now, the reason I mention this, especially in light of Boston, is that we don't know about these stories very well. We hear the stories of the prominent white churches, but we don't hear the stories about the Spanish-speaking congregations, the Asian-American congregations, the African-American churches. And so one of the questions that I'm asking is, we are entering into a new era of Christianity in the 21st century, where the majority culture is going to be shaped not so much by European culture, but by cultures outside of Europe and North America. And I argue that the trends of diversity in American society are actually hitting the church faster than what's happening in American society. In other words, there is greater diversity in the church right now than there is in American society at large. At the same time, there is greater segregation in the church than there is in the world out there. So this is sad for me because I look at, you know, most of us in our work environment, when we go into our work environment, we see multi-ethnicity right in front of us, right? We see that we have a diverse group of fellow employees. You get all the employees together at a company picnic. You realize, wow, this is a very diverse work environment. And yet when many of us go to church, those churches don't reflect that diversity. Michael Emerson, who's a sociologist down at Rice University, says that, this is Curtis DeYoung's study at Bethel University. He says that only about 7.5% or 8% of the churches are considered ethnically diverse, multi-ethnic. And that's using the categories of 80% of one group and 20% of another group means you're ethnically diverse. And at the same time, only about 7 or 8% of American churches qualify. And in fact, they argue that if you take that number and you kind of slice through it, you'll find out that half of those churches are actually churches in transitions, in neighborhoods that are going from all white to all black or vice versa. And therefore, within 10 years, those churches won't be diverse anymore. They'll actually take on the ethnic characteristics of that community. So what we're seeing is that only about 3.5% to 4% of American churches are actually considered ethnically diverse. That's a shame. That's a tragedy. I mean, if you thought of any other institution that had that low a level of diversity, you know, we would be up in arms, and that's not the way it should be. Michael Emerson's study was showing that public schools are 6 times more diverse than churches. He went and did studies of all the most segregated cities in America and found that they have an index of what he called diversity index of 0.6, meaning the most segregated cities would need 60% of its city population disrupted in some way in order for there to be integration. The higher the number, the worse the segregation. He applied the same metrics to American evangelical churches and found that we have an index of 0.91. So the most segregated cities have an index of 0.6. We have an index of 0.91, meaning 91% of our churches would have to be disrupted in some way in order for there to be integration. So Emerson goes on to say, those numbers in American history have only been attained by Jim Crow laws. It took Jim Crow laws to level to create that level of segregation. And yet here we are in the 21st century, and our churches are doing as poorly as the society during the time of Jim Crow laws. That is shameful. That is shameful. So one of the questions I want to ask is, what does it mean for a church to look towards the future and say, we really want to be a church that embraces the work of God in diversity? Not to be one of those churches that are stuck in the era of Jim Crow, but to look ahead to the next 100 years, the next 50 years, I'm amazed that this church has been around for over a century. You've traversed 3 centuries, the 19th, 20th, and the 21st. And as you think of ministry for the 21st century, what would it mean to embrace this diversity that's already here and to truly be a church that reflects your community? Let me pause there and open it up for questions and answers.
I wonder if I can get one more person, Mark. You want to come and be a roving mic? So maybe just raise your hand if there's a question that you have.
As you were speaking, I was just wondering what implications all of your information has for missions and the future of missions.
Yeah, this is where it's great work, and a lot of the statistics I quoted at the end are actually missiologists. Dana Robert, Andrew Walls, Jenkins is not, but Walls, Robert are missiologists who are thinking through these things. I'm going to be speaking at Regent College over the summer at a missiology conference where Andrew Walls, Mark Knoll, Ruth Padilla-DeBorst, and Terry LeBlanc, the five of us, are speaking on the future of global Christianity. So this is very much an issue at hand right now. I think one of the things we have to think through is, how is missions going to operate differently when we go to nations that are more Christian than the U.S. is, right? So, you know, when you say, oh, we're going to have a summer mission trip to Kenya, and Kenya is overwhelmingly Christian, you know, I mean, what are you going to do? And this is where my experience with the native community has really been helpful. Some of the best mentors I've had in terms of missiology has actually been Native Americans. One of my dear friends, his name is Richard Twist. He passed away recently. A brilliant thinker on missiology, but from a Native American perspective, he was a Lakota Sioux. And he wrote a book called One Church, Many Tribes. But the original title of the book was actually called 500 Years of Bad Haircuts. And the publisher says, yeah, we can't use that title. But the idea behind 500 Years of Bad Haircuts is that as a Native American, for 500 years, we had Western missionaries come to our reservations and try to convert us to white Christianity, essentially. You told us we couldn't use our native drums. You told us we had to cut our hair, 500 years of bad haircuts. You told us to change our names from our Lakota and Cree and all these names to westernized names. And for after 500 years of some of the most intense missionary efforts, we have the highest rate of alcoholism. We have the highest rate of violence, the highest rate of unemployment. So what have 500 years of bad haircuts gotten us? And he alludes to the fact that every year on his reservation, a mission group from an American church or a white American church comes, and they paint the barn one color. Next week, another church comes, and they paint the barn another color. And another church comes, and they paint the barn another color. And they do the same VBS material week in and week out, and the same 50 kids get saved for those 13 consecutive weeks. Now he's asking the question, that's wonderful. We love the effort there, but what does it mean to actually be in partnership with the native community? I think the lessons we can learn from what the native community is saying about 500-year mission history are the lessons that we can begin to learn in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. One of the influences on my thinking on this is Oscar Murillo, who used to pastor, I think he retired recently, at Nairobi Chapel. And at an Urbana conference, he talked about, if you keep sending us short-term missionaries, then maybe you need to start taking some short-term missionaries. So he was saying, okay, you send us 20 of your missionaries to Kenya, and we will have a learning community with our Nairobi Chapel folks, and then we'll send 20 of our folks to your church, and they will have an opportunity to engage in ministry. And that will be a more mutual learning experience, rather than we're sending 20 of our kids to paint your barn for the 15th day in a row.
Just a quick question. What hasn't been noted here is the issue of economics.
Yes.
And can you just address that a little bit, economic segregation?
Yeah. As some of you know, I pastored a multi-ethnic church for 10 years. And we were diverse on all levels, in our congregation, in our leadership, and our pastoral staff. We really introduced intentional diversity on all three levels. We had more trouble dealing with socioeconomic, or more of an issue, or more difficulty attaining socioeconomic integration. So racially diverse congregations are becoming a little bit easier as long as people are same on the same educational and socioeconomic level. So we had the African American elder on my church was a Yale graduate. The Latino graduate member of my church, of my elder board, was Columbia undergrad and Harvard grad school. So that was kind of the themes. And my Haitian American woman on our staff was a Wellesley, Boston College, Northwestern, Gordon Conwell graduate. So, you know, I mean, that's the kind of reality we had in Boston, that to do racial diversity was actually doable, but to do socioeconomic diversity, much more difficult. And sometimes they do overlap with one another. So part of it, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this tonight and tomorrow, is how do we develop cultural sensitivity, not only for racial differences and racial cultural differences, but also how do we do this in socioeconomic diversity as well? Great question. I think you're on.
So when you began, you talked about safety and discomfort in discipleship. And my thought when you're talking about diversity is, and the Jim Crow laws, basically, and not to be critical, but I'm assuming a lot of these churches are self-selected. We choose to go to church. And so I'm just wondering if you can speak at all about just safe, like bounce back to safety and discomfort as you know, something that we choose and maybe what the Lord is choosing for us. I mean, not that the Lord always chooses the same thing,
sure,
but, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Maybe a little more.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think if I'm not answering yours, let me know, but I think I'm getting the gist of your question. I'll use my mom as an example. My mom is 81, you know, I kind of shared a little bit of her story last night in telling my story as well. But when I pastored a multi-ethnic church, and she would come visit me from Maryland to Massachusetts and come visit her church, she went to a Korean church in the morning before coming to our service. I was a little offended. I was like, Mom, you're my mother, and you're going to a different church in the morning. I was like, well, I wouldn't understand what you're saying anyway, so at least I'm there. And she's in the back reading her Korean Bible. But, you know, I actually didn't get offended at that because I realized that for 6 days out of the week, she operated in a culture and language that was not her own. And so for me to say, well, I'm multi-ethnic pastor and all that stuff, and no, she needed that one place a week where she could speak and act in the language and culture that was familiar to her. Because the world that she lived in 6 days out of that week was not normal for her, was not safe for her. So that's where that safe place occurs. Now, that's when we kind of talk about other, that's why I really do affirm, I'm not, there was a theory that was put out by Emerson and Yancey and DeYoung and Chai Kim, who essentially said that all churches should try to be multi-ethnic. I'm actually not, I don't actually buy into that, because I think there are too many places where ethnic-specific ministries are still needed. And I would specifically point to African-American churches where there's a long history of oppression in the culture that developed out of that context, but also recent immigrant for language and cultural reasons. So I don't think it's possible that all churches should be multi-ethnic, but we should certainly have more than 4% of churches be multi-ethnic. So I think that's where we start transitioning into, yes, there are certain communities that we still need to see because of safety reasons, because of comfort reasons, especially as immigrants who spend 6 days of the week operating under a culture that is not their own, to have that one day a week where they feel affirmed in their ethnic identity. I think that's necessary. But then we got to talk about second generation, like myself, whose parents are first generation, but I'm more, you know, I was educated in the United States, I'm more comfortable with English than in Korean. Then we start talking about predominantly white communities that have 6 days out of the week, most of their culture affirmed throughout the week. And is there a place where that discomfort is introduced that seventh day of the week? Does that answer your question?
You kind of address this a little bit from the perspective of the ethnic church.
Yeah.
People, ethnic believers wanting to be comfortable in their own language.
Yeah.
But if I try to ask you my question in a foreign language, it's a European language. So what encouragement or advice can you give to me, for example, to be able to interact with an ethnic church, an immigrant church, that's, as you put up the numbers, is, you know, conducting services in a language I don't understand.
Yeah.
And they're comfortable in a language I don't understand.
Yeah. No, that's a great question.
So maybe that's the point, part of your point. That's where my discomfort is.
But yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. And one of the ways that I didn't get to the two Bible verses at the end where I wanted to loop back into Acts chapter 15. And the question I ask is, even as an immigrant or an ethnic minority in the United States, and there are varying degrees of this depending on the culture group that you're a part of, you encounter discomfort all the time in some form or another. Whereas in majority culture, most of the cultural icons and values around you are actually affirming your culture. So I was reading this. I try to keep in touch with pop culture as much as possible because that's the way I learn about how to communicate to the world around me. And I was reading Entertainment Weekly on the plane over, and one of the articles that I saw was they were talking about the movie Fast and Furious Part 6. I had no idea they were up to Part 6. But anyway, one of the things they were talking about in this movie is that this is one of the few movies that have come out in the last few years where a person of color speaks to a person of a different color, an Asian talking to a Latino talking to an African-American, without a white person in the mix. I said, is that really true? And I was trying to think of a major blockbuster movie. The only movie I could think of was 42, the movie about Jackie Robinson, where people of color speak to each other. But he said this is one of the few movies that has ever had depicted people of color speaking to each other without a white person present in the background. So what it shows is that if you look at, so, I mean, Entertainment Weekly really points this out to me. If you look at the television programs, if you look at the movies, if you look at the books that we read, we tend to operate under a majority cultural frame of reference. And we don't even realize it because that's the world that we live in. And so there's comfort for us in that, to go flip on the television and recognize that all the heroes on television are most likely to be white males or females. Right now, it's a big deal that Scandal on one of the networks features an African-American female lead. And they were saying it's the first time in 40 years that they've had an African-American female lead on a major network television show. So, I mean, that's what I mean by the culture that we swim in. I'm using pop cultural references. The culture we swim in tends to affirm the identity of white Americans. And so that's where, okay, but where is that moment of discomfort of that for the white American? Because if you go to church, and your church is majority culture as well, now you're again in another place where there's an affirmation of your culture. Where is the place where you are introduced to a different cultural framework or reference? And sometimes that's going to be linguistic. But sometimes it doesn't have to be. That's why I'm alluding to, for example, Asian American churches, Latino churches, Caribbean churches, African American churches that conduct a service other than in the language, other than their own language, they actually conduct it in English. So there are places where you can still have that encounter in English as well. But I'm pointing out that those communities, that's the one place where their culture and language is affirmed. Where for most of us in majority culture, we know there are a lot of places where culture and language are affirmed.
How does the trend for these big mega churches, so-called Acts 29 churches, to fit into this? They're a huge growth spurt throughout the country. There's one in Granite Bay close to us. And are they ethnically diverse? I think they tend to be, but I'm not sure. And are they socioeconomically diverse?
Yeah. Well, I'll make a couple of comments. The mega church is a different issue from Acts 29. I'll distinguish that. Mark Shevs at Duke recognized that the level of diversity in megachurches are actually higher than your typical churches. And a couple of factors for that. One is that megachurches, which tend to be in the suburbs, are a destination church for immigrant groups with experiencing social uplift. So, you know, kind of the typical immigrant story is you start off in urban, ethnic-specific immigrant communities. But then by the second generation, your children are educated, and you move out to the suburbs with kind of social uplift. And we saw this in Boston in a church called Grace Chapel. Where you had these immigrant communities, Chinese communities, Brazilian communities, Haitian communities, those who had kind of the social uplift would move to Lexington, which is where Grace Chapel is, better schools, suburban homes, and they would attend Grace Chapel, mainly because they wanted their children, who are now second generation, to be more assimilated into American culture. So what Chefs found was that megachurches are actually doing a little bit better for in terms of ethnic diversity. Acts 29 is a little bit of a different story because they tend to be church planters, and they tend to operate as church planters. And this is sort of a cop-out. I'm willing to have a private conversation on this. I'm trying to do a little bit more research on this. My initial take on Acts 29 Network is that they tend to be white church planters moving into urban neighborhoods. And I'll say that. I won't say this on the record at this particular point. I'm writing on this right now and doing some of the research on this. But the question is it a healthy dynamic that's actually occurring? There's a couple of articles on this, and I'm working on an article. Actually, last night I was working on this article for the Christian Community Development Association Theological Journal about is it actually a good narrative to have white transplants moving into black and Latino neighborhoods without a cultural sensitivity to that neighborhood. And you end up planting churches there, but it doesn't necessarily actually serve that community. It actually almost in many senses exploits that community. So, and I'm not saying that specifically for Acts 29. I think just kind of church planting in general, we have to think through what are the paradigms that we're using. Are we saying we're still kind of the missionaries to help save, or are we those coming to work alongside the communities that are already doing good work in those communities?
You know, I think given our time, we probably can't take any more questions now, but I would definitely direct you to come and grab Sungshan and have a chance to have a conversation with him. But I am just so grateful for you being here and for you sharing with us this morning. And really, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Much food for that.